Welcome to a special episode of Off the Chart, a Business of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Keith Reynolds. With the rise of vaccine hesitancy as a major force in U.S. healthcare, doctors everywhere are looking for leadership. For this episode, Medical Economics joined forces with Infection Control Today to bring together a roundtable of experts with the aim of trying to make sense of the current climate around vaccines in America. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Good afternoon, and welcome to our panel discussion, Navigating the New World of Vaccines in 2025. My name is Heather Stoltzfus, and I'm honored to be your moderator for this critical and timely conversation. I'm a research nurse program manager with Johns Hopkins University Division of Infectious Disease, senior infection prevention consultant for Broad Street Prevention, and an editorial advisor for Infection Control Today. We're standing at a crossroads in public health. On one hand, we're witnessing an extraordinary era of vaccine innovation, new platforms, new protection, and new possibilities for disease prevention. On the other hand, we're grappling with an unprecedented erosion of public trust. Vaccine misinformation is no longer a fringe issue. It's a mainstream force, reshaping clinical workflows, public health strategies, and national policy. In 2025, the science for vaccines has never been stronger, but science is no longer enough. That's why we're here today. We've brought together a powerhouse panel of experts, frontline physicians, national policy leaders, and infectious disease specialists to help us make sense of this evolving landscape. We'll examine the implications of recent policy shifts, unpack the real-world impact of vaccine hesitancy, and most importantly, discuss how we can lead with evidence, empathy, and action. This isn't just about staying informed. It's about staying engaged. And as physicians, infection preventionists, leaders, and advocates, we each have a role to play in rebuilding confidence and reinforcing the foundational promise of public health. Before we dive into today's discussion, let me take a moment to introduce the incredible panelists who are joining us today. Each of them brings a unique perspective from the front lines of healthcare, policy, and infectious disease prevention. And together, they'll help us to navigate this complex and ever-evolving vaccine landscape. Dr. Georges Benjamin is the Executive Director of the American Public Health Association and one of the nation's most influential voices in public health policy. Dr. Benjamin champions policies that promote disease prevention, health equity, and community well-being. Dr. Jen Brohl is President of the American Academy of Family Physicians. A 20-plus year family physician, she has also served for 12 years as the health officer for the Rooks County, Kansas Health Department. Dr. William Schaffner is a renowned infectious disease specialist and professor of preventive medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He has served as a liaison to CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, helping shape national vaccine guidelines. Dr. Tina Tan is a pediatric infectious disease specialist who is the professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Renowned for her work on vaccine-preventable diseases, she conducts research and collaborates on national guidelines aimed at improving pediatric care. She currently serves as the president for the Infectious Disease Society of America. Dr. Charles Vega is a clinical professor of family medicine at the UC Irvine School of Medicine, where he also serves as the associate dean for culture and community education. With a focus on health equity, he has dedicated much of his career to improving patient outcomes among underserved communities through culturally responsive care. I just want to take a moment to extend my sincere thanks to each of you for being here today. We are so incredibly grateful and excited to have such a breadth of experience and insight on today's panel. So to kick us off, I want to go around the panel and get each of your assessments on the state of vaccination in 2025. What are your thoughts on where we are as a nation when it comes to vaccine policy, patient acceptance, and more? We'll start with Dr. Benjamin.
Thank you, Heather. I think the real challenge we have here is if we're in an era of eroding trust, increased misinformation, and tragically poor national leadership that we're seeing each and every day. And I think the challenge that we have with that is that it allows for the undermining of our capacity to maintain an era of vaccine equity and accomplishment. You know, we've done a really good job, particularly with childhood vaccines, not so much a great job with adult vaccines. And we were just on the cusp of turning the corner and putting in place a very aggressive vaccine program for adults to try to emulate what we did with kids. And now, in many ways, we're going to have to now just rebuild our children's vaccine programs as well as our adult vaccine program going forward.
So much potential, so much promise, and wrought with many challenges. Thank you for that perspective, Dr. Benjamin. Dr. Brill.
We're at a pivotal moment. Vaccines continue to be one of the most powerful tools we have to protect public health. A 2024 study published in The Lancet estimated that vaccines have saved 154 million lives globally since 1974, most of them young children under five. At the same time, we are facing a rising tide of misinformation that is eroding public confidence. The recent measles outbreaks are a stark reminder of what's at stake when our vaccination rates fall. And there is good news. Trust in local leaders, especially physicians, remains strong. According to the 2024 Edelman Trust Barometer, 83% of people say they trust doctors to tell them the truth about protecting public health. As family physicians, we're deeply connected to our patients and our communities, and we have a unique opportunity and responsibility to rebuild vaccine confidence one conversation at a time.
Thank you for that, Dr. Brill. Those statistics are staggering, and yet it underscores the importance of us being here and having those conversations today. Dr. Schaffner, I'm curious what you have to add.
Well, actually, it's difficult to be more eloquent than my colleagues already have been. They've made the point very, very clearly. I think we are in a tenuous current position with vaccines, and that saddens my heart profoundly. This issue of trust mentioned by Dr. Benjamin is critical. We have to try to restore that trust, not just in vaccines, but in public health and medicine generally. I come down to that old equation, disease bad, vaccines good.
Thank you for that. I couldn't agree anymore. Dr. Tan.
I definitely echo everything that my esteemed colleagues have said. I mean, with the erosion of trust and with the significant increase in vaccine hesitancy, anti-science, misinformation, disinformation, and basically vaccine refusal, this is really putting a major issue on the pediatric patients, especially because they can't advocate for themselves to basically get vaccinated to protect themselves. So I think for us, we really need to be strong advocates and really try to counteract what is being put out on social media, because that's where a lot of, I can say, parents are getting their information from, is they're getting all this disinformation, misinformation from social media. And that really just rapidly spreads very, very quickly.
Dr. Tan, thank you so much for highlighting the impact to the pediatric population. We're going to get into that a little bit more in this discussion. But Dr. Vega.
Yeah, those are great points. I love all of them. 5 years ago, I did not experience a vaccine hesitancy or refusal in my community health center. It was something I heard about and I was concerned with. But that's changed for all of us since COVID-19. And so now we have this this real duty. And I think it's a call to action. And I would just say to those on the front lines, don't give up. You're a healthcare professional. As Dr. Brill said, you are the trusted person here. It's not the crazy aunt or uncle. It's not the influencer, which is the stated career objective of all my children. It's actually you as a healthcare professional. And don't stop trying. How many times have you had that patient? You talked about the vaccine three times, four times, and this vaccine X, doesn't matter which one. And suddenly just something clicks, fine, doc, I'll get it. I think that's, you got me. That's a good idea. And so those little wins go a long way. And when you establish trust, it's not just the vaccines that get done, It's the breast cancer screening. It's the regular use of, say, anti-diabetes medications. It's lifestyle changes that promote healthier living. And so vaccines can really be a catalyst for just a better health exchange with your patients.
Thank you for that, Dr. Vega. I'm hearing from all of you that the current state of vaccination is occurring on a spectrum, and from national policy to what happens inside the exam room, we're hearing this well-rounded perspective on the state of vaccination. And let's dig into that a little bit more and discuss what we've seen over the past few years pertaining to the state of innovation regarding vaccines. I know we've seen a lot of significant innovation over the past few years, from vaccines for RSV to new mRNA platforms. Dr. Schaffner, how would you describe the current state of vaccine innovation in the US today?
Oh, I think the state of the research and the production of new vaccines is flourishing and exciting. Just think about this a little bit. Recently, new and improved vaccines have come out against Mpox, RSV, pneumococcal infections, Lyme disease, dengue, CMV, chikungunya. We're now thinking about giving fewer doses of HPV vaccine because that vaccine is so fabulously effective. My goodness. And we're also thinking about new ways to deliver vaccines through microneedle patches. Maybe that will be something. Oral vaccines. What a way to deliver vaccines in the future. All of that's in the works, that kind of religious ferment, investigative research ferment is out there. That said, let me remind everyone that as our colleague Walt Orenstein likes to say, vaccines don't prevent disease. Vaccination prevents disease. And as I like to say, vaccine in the refrigerator never yet prevented a single case of infection. So where we need even more investigation, innovation, energy is the delivery of vaccines. How do we bring these populations, these diverse populations in this wonderfully diverse country that we have, closer to the vaccine so we can move it out of the refrigerator and into the arm? There we need much more work. Much has to be done locally, just as Chuck Vega has said, by each individual healthcare provider. I'm sure we're going to come back to that several times again. But how to move the vaccines out of the refrigerator and into those, at the moment, arms, is something we need to pay more attention to, and we need more innovation.
Dr. Schaffner, I think that is worth restating. We can't have vaccines in the refrigerator and not in arms. Absolutely. I think that's such a powerful point that you're making. And I love your excitement. I share your excitement about the innovation of vaccines. I still get excited when I think about the fact that we eradicated smallpox using vaccination. And I don't think I was even born then. So this is such an exciting place that we're at in this state of vaccine innovation. So thank you for those perspectives and reflections. Dr. Tan, how would you describe the current state? Anything to add to Dr. Schaffner's insights?
I mean, I think Bill really just summarized it in a fantastic way. I mean, obviously the goal is to try and develop and produce the safest and most effective vaccines. But if you can't get it to the person, that's a problem. And that's an issue that is becoming more widespread with these new policies and executive orders that the administration has put out. I mean, when they basically cut USAID, we were providing vaccines and other medications to low to middle income countries. And now they don't have the people to administer it. So you can't get the medication or the vaccine to these individuals. And I mean, that is a major problem. But, you know, as Bill brought up, there are other vaccine types that are in development. So whether it's oral, whether it's intranasal, you know, things like that. And there are other platforms that are being studied right now. So you have basically viral vector platforms. You have DNA vaccine platforms. synthetic virus platforms, nanoparticle vaccine platforms. So, I mean, this is all very, very exciting because there are all these different platforms that are being looked at to try and produce safe and effective vaccines more rapidly. And, you know, one new vaccine that's in development that used an mRNA platform for use in infants and children is a combination human metapneumovirus and parainfluenza type 3 virus. And we know that during respiratory seasons, both these viruses cause a lot of disease in infants and children. So if we get a vaccine that's effective against it, that'd be great. But, you know, I think we still have to continue to advocate for the incredible research that is being done in this area.
That's great. Thank you, Dr. Tanya. So much that is being done, but so much that still has yet to be done. And with that innovation, we have to continue to advocate for public trust. And of course, you mentioned it, policy. Policy has to also keep pace with the innovation that we're seeing in vaccines, which really brings me into our next question. I think it's safe to say that everything is different now. I've heard this echoed in the conversation already. When it comes to national policy in 2025, there's growing concern about the political leadership of HHS, about how vaccine-related decisions are being made. Dr. Benjamin, I know this is a big question, but how are current federal policies impacting public health vaccination goals? We see all this innovation, but how is public policy impacting our ability to move forward?
You know, Heather, the way I like to think about this is in three areas: policy, coherent messaging, and infrastructure. And if you think about the fact that we had a very rational and science-driven process to to evaluate vaccines, look at the regulatory aspects of that and regulate them through the FDA. And then they would move that to the CDC, who would then refine who got it under what conditions. And then collectively, the federal government would make a national recommendation. And then we would implement those recommendations based on the systems that we had in place. You know, during COVID, we increased the number of people to give shots, the number of places to give shots, and actually improved our ability to get people to those places to get shots in arms. That's been taken apart, including making the policymaking process unsure. We've had this lack of consistent, coherent messaging. You know, well, the question about vaccines, but okay, it's all right to get your measles shot, but maybe not. And so this lack of coherent messaging means that we've learned, or at least on the implementation side, nothing about risk communication, about the importance of consistent messaging as part of the process. That's evidence-based. And then finally, Dr. Schaefer said it, as he always does best, vaccines do no one any good in the freezer, on the shelf, if you can't get shots in arms. And the challenge is they have, quite frankly, taken apart the infrastructure to get shots in arms. The core public health infrastructure right now has been decimated already. Look, the measles outbreak that we have right now, the funding cuts that they hit, we lost vaccinators the same day in Texas when the funding cuts hit. And that trickle down to local communities has disrupted the federal, state, local partnership that we have with vaccines. So we're very concerned about that. And we're hoping, you know, on the next 100 days, the administration reverses course and begins to rebuild this system very much like we had it before. And let's prove upon it. But that system needs to be rebuilt.
It's heartbreaking. I've heard it said already in this conversation. It really is heartbreaking. Some of just the trickle-down effect, like you said, Dr. Benjamin, that we're seeing from some of these public policy decisions. And I think you're reminding us that public health decisions are never made in a vacuum, that one part of the system affects all parts of the systems, and that, you know, those policy shifts are affecting every part of the population, and this decimation of public health is affecting every part of the population. And that includes children. And I think especially children. And I know, Dr. Tan, you had spoken to this a little bit earlier, so I want to kind of shift our focus and talk about pediatrics for a moment in our next topic. In many ways, pediatric vaccination is really what's under fire. We're seeing consistently declining vaccination rates, and according to many polls, age-appropriate vaccination is now deemed less important by parents with every year. Right now, I know we've mentioned the measles outbreak previously, just to share some statistics, it's spreading to more than 25 states in the nation, and it's resulted in the death already of two unvaccinated children. So Dr. Tan, can you explain the current state of pediatric vaccination, and what is it that you think we need to do to push back against some of these trends and troubling events?
Yeah, I mean, you summarized it well. I mean, what we're seeing is a significant decline in pediatric routine vaccination rates, with a marked increase in parents that are vaccine hesitant, that are anti-science, and that are anti-vaccine. And much of this information and disinformation is being spread widely, as I mentioned before, by social media. So they basically, you know, believe their aunt, their uncle, their cousin who says, no, you should not give your child the vaccine. It's not worth it. Vaccines are experimental. And instead of talking to their healthcare provider or, you know, finding sites with sound scientifically based information, they basically take the word of individuals on social media and they believe them. And that results in these kids not being vaccinated. So I think as healthcare providers, we all need to continue to strongly advocate for and provide the best care to our patients and encourage them to be vaccinated, as this is the best mode of protection for persons of every age, but especially for infants and children. And basically, we need to take the time to speak with our vaccine hesitant patients to find out what their concerns are about the vaccines and address these concerns in an empathetic manner and provide them with scientifically sound information to get them to understand the importance of vaccines and protecting them, their children, their family, and basically have them understand why we are really advocating for them to receive the vaccines.
Yeah, I think I hear a formula here, Dr. Tan. It is evidence plus empathy plus and foremost listening. Listening to their concerns and having dialogue, discussion, conversations around what those concerns are. But I think right now, again, going back to policy is driving some of this misinformation and concern as well, as people are hearing in the news and on social media, as you highlighted, some concern around vaccines. So let's talk a little bit about how public policy is supporting or undermining pediatric efforts. Dr. Schaffner, can you tell me what policy levers, federal, state, local, do you think could have the biggest impact on our vaccine acceptance over the next few years?
Well, Heather, do you want the good news or the bad news? I don't think I would have said that a year and a half ago, but we're concerned now about, as we have mentioned already, national policies that in a variety of ways discourage vaccination. I'm going to open this up a little bit for consideration. We in medicine and public health have taken this problem on. This is a medical and public health problem. Yes, I'm going to expand that a little bit because I also think it's an educational problem. Several of us has just looked quickly. We didn't do a survey. That's much too formal. But we look quickly at the health curricula in middle school and high school. And you know, vaccines are taught modestly, erratically, and certainly the vaccine preventable diseases themselves are hardly ever mentioned. So I think if we did do a survey and went to high school seniors and asked them two simple questions, what's a vaccine? How does a vaccine work? And hoped for simple English declarative responses. Oh, a vaccine, something you get in order to prevent disease. Great, 100%. the vaccine works? Well, it works by stimulating the immune system, so we're prevented, protected in the future. I don't think we would get that very often. I think we'd go, I think we'd get that. So I think we need to expand our reach and reach out to our colleagues in education and try to get that curriculum in middle school and high school enhanced regarding vaccines and vaccine preventable diseases. Those are the people who in a few years, hello, they're the parents asking the questions. Mm-hmm. So yes, it's a medical issue. It certainly is a public health issue, but I think it's an educational issue also.
That's incredible insight, Dr. Schaffner. I had never thought before about the importance of starting with our middle schoolers. I have middle schoolers, and of course they know the importance of vaccines because of what mom does, but I'm sure you're right. If they polled their friends, they probably wouldn't have the same answers as my boys do. So thank you for that insight in how educational policy can even drive vaccine acceptance in the future. Dr. Benjamin, do you have anything to add to what policy levers might be able to make an impact on vaccine acceptance, both in the positive and the negative?
Oh, yeah. Well, let me disagree with Dr. Schaffner, first of all. Absolutely. I think that one of the challenges we have is the whole issue around health literacy in our population. We have, you know, grown up a population of people who don't know first aid. They really don't understand the human body. Biology classes and many of the sciences have been de-emphasized. And I think that's certainly a first step. I think the other thing we need to do is do a better job of making our policymakers more scientifically literate. Because I get to tell you, I think that there's a gap there as well. And I think there's an enormous opportunity for our professional societies. If the federal government won't do it, I think the professional societies can fill that gap. You heard earlier from Dr. Brewer how trusted physicians are, and we're still very trusted. And I think there's an opportunity there for us to serve as the chief health advisors to our local elected officials at the local level, and then at the national level to do the same thing. And there's a big area there, an opportunity there to rebuild that relationship so that they'll come to us when they're doing policymaking. And of course, that means educating their staff, because their staff are also the ones that, you know, influence them a lot.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add on? Because I think this is a fascinating line of conversation that I really believe in, that I think that one thing that's been laid bare, Dr. Tan mentioned, you know, anti-science. There has been, I think that over the past 5 years, we see just what a huge gap there is in just understanding of science and the scientific method overall. And, you know, while it was incredible that the COVID-19 vaccines on that first iteration were so effective, 95% plus vaccine efficacy, outstanding. But then with mutations of the virus, naturally, the vaccines were less effective, remained effective, particularly for preventing severe disease. But other vaccines were tried and didn't have very strong efficacy. And I really got a sense from the public, like, see, nobody knows what they're doing. This is, we could throw out the whole lot of it. And it just takes a little bit of distrust and a little bit of a sense of confusion to result in, I'm just going to dismiss this out of hand. And unfortunately, that's the scientific method. That's how science works. My seven-year-olds were reciting that to me at that time. And so I really think that this is this is a broader issue. It's going to take time. Everything we're talking about is really going to take time. So dig in for the long haul. But I saw that through the pandemic, just that we really need a better grasp of science as a society.
Yeah, thank you for that insight, Dr. Vega, and for highlighting that, because I think that some of the misinformation that we're seeing, yes, maybe comes from social media, but it comes at the very grassroots level from a misunderstanding of the scientific method and science in general, and how vaccines are developed or formed, and how these organisms mutate over time, and how that changes things for us too. So I appreciate that insight, because I think that that's really helpful for clinicians to hear and guiding their patients in those conversations. And I think while policy is essential, I'm hearing that what is happening on the front lines in the exam rooms is just as, if not more important, because our patients trust their clinicians. And so primary care, especially pediatrics, family medicine, you know, you're all on the front line there when it comes to vaccine information. And Dr. Brill, how would you approach a patient, a parent, or a caregiver who's already coming in skeptical, maybe because of something they've seen or they've read or heard online?
I'm always reassured that when Edelman does their trust barometer, that physicians and particularly primary care specialists rise to the top there. And I'm reminded that trust is earned in drops and lost in buckets. And this is a time in which we're sort of going through that bucketing as a society around the tools that medicine and science have given us to combat disease. So when a patient trusts me enough to open that conversation, to tell me that they are worried about a recommendation that I've made, I always approach that, as Dr. Tan does, with listening. And I assume good intent. Most people want to do what is healthiest and best for them, their children, their families. And understanding where that hesitation comes from. Did it come from a social media post? Did it come from a family member? Did it come from a personal experience with vaccines? Is always a good step. And then next, really digging in to understand what piece of the puzzle is the one that distresses them most is important. Because if I start with a spiel that lands on none of the questions they have or concerns they have, I am not going to move a vaccine from the refrigerator to an arm. And it is all about demonstrating that I trust them to have this conversation and that I trust that their concerns are valid and that I'm in it for the long haul. So if today you don't make this decision, I want to leave that conversation open for you to call me back tomorrow or to have another conversation in a month when I see you again. And so I very carefully don't burn any capital in those conversations, but rather extend my trust of our relationship. And then finally, the tactic that I always use is talking about my family and my personal choices and their personal choices. And often I used to say in practice, let me take off my doctor hat, let me put on my mom hat. Everybody in my small community knew I had three children. And when I said all three of my kids got this vaccine, it meant a lot more because I made that decision as a mom, not as a doctor. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brill. And thank you again for highlighting the importance of listening and empathy and understanding and leading with those in the conversations with our patients. Dr. Vega, do you have anything to add to that conversation about how to approach a patient or a parent or caregiver who's skeptical about vaccines?
Oh, no, not much to add to Dr. Brill's excellent advice. That's really great. So you personalize the experience, you talk about from your perspective, not a time to bring up the CDC, not a time to just to whip out charts on vaccine efficacy versus side effects. But really, like, I get this, my mom gets this, my kids get this. And then, but it does start, though. That's kind of the tail end. The front end is so important to just practice active listening. And I use an iterative approach, and I really try to just, you know, explore patients' reasoning. And many times there's not a specific reason. There's more of a general dis-ease with the concept of vaccination versus like, oh, but it's going to cause myocarditis or it's going to cause, you know, cancer or something like that. And so therefore it's just kind of working with patients and then kind of guiding them gently back to the benefits, which are manifold of vaccination. And I feel that's the best approach. I would just add as well, when we think about important influences, make sure that you want to talk to your staff, because if you have one of your staff, when they're actually applying that vaccine arm and they're saying, yeah, I don't know about this vaccine, I heard some sketchy things about it, that can really just explode everything you just tried to construct. So you really want a team approach. We're all part of the healthcare team with a patient in the center. So just make sure that that's something you address early before you initiate those vaccine discussions.
Thank you for those insights and tips. Dr. Benjamin, how can clinicians use their role to rebuild vaccine confidence in the populations that they serve?
You know, I think this is a responsibility for all clinicians. And so I tell people, even if you're not someone who gives vaccinations as a part of your routine practice, be informed. Because in the public's mind, a doctor is a doctor is a doctor, right? So be informed so that you can speak confidently about current recommendations. And then normalize vaccine delivery so that it's not viewed as something that's outside of the normative practice, that people see it as part of their routine care. We take their blood pressure, we take their temperature. Nowadays, we take their pulse ox. And we talk about screening for diseases, and we talk about what's your vaccine status today. So they hear that every time they walk in the office, and it's part of their routine updating. And then, as you heard from Dr. Tan and Dr. Vega, listen, 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 listen. Listen for those clues that there may be some concerns about it. And when they express those concerns, I know that we only have a few minutes in every clinical encounter, but when you hear those concerns, that's the key to stop, open up your ears, close your mouth, and understand what those tips are. It will save you a lot of heartburn trying to deal with those patients in the past, you know, in the future as you're going forward with them, dealing with past issues of concerns. And sometimes simply that reassurance, as you heard, I'm a parent. My kids do this. Here's some materials that I can give you to read. We can talk about this on your next visit or tomorrow, whatever. But always leaving that door open so they can come back and express their concerns about it. It's very important.
Thank you for that, Dr. Benjamin. I hear that theme of listening again. Listening is that theme that carries through all of your responses today. And I think it's just so important to hear. And I appreciate Dr. Brohl offering that statistic as well about how trusted our frontline clinicians are. I think that's where these conversations and the trajectory of vaccine acceptance has the opportunity to have the greatest impact is really with our frontline clinicians in the exam room. But let's widen that lens just a little bit from the individual conversations that we have with our patients to the larger role that our medical societies play in shaping the national narrative. Dr. Tan and Dr. Brohl, you're both now leading national associations, IDSA and AAFP. From your vantage point, what role should physician specialty societies play in pushing back against some of these harmful policy changes and advocating for both clinicians and the patients that they serve?
So during these very tumultuous and chaotic times, the role and the action of physician specialty societies are now significantly more important than they ever have been, because we need to advocate for and fight to for our colleagues and the patients that we are privileged to serve. And I think one of the big things is that working collaboratively as a coalition of societies on a variety of issues really provides a much stronger voice and message and will have a much greater impact. And I can tell you from the Infectious Disease Society of America, that's what we've been doing. And we've also been trying to expand the spectrum of individuals that we speak with, whether it's our members, whether it's members of other societies, whether it's our patients, whether it's you know, the people in Congress and their aides. We've even tried to reach out to HHS Secretary Kennedy to try to get an appointment to meet with him. And I know this was brought up before, but what we're trying to do is to educate the policymakers on why, you know, certain cuts and all these executive orders are not appropriate, because they will severely impact the public health of every single American. And that even expands out to globally, with all the cuts that were made with USAID and PEPFAR and even Gavi, which is a major supplier of vaccines to low-income countries. We know that the cuts that happened with Gavi, over 75 million infants and children will not receive their basic vaccination to protect them against vaccine-preventable diseases.
Dr. Tan, it's inspiring to hear how IDSA is leaning in and leading the way with other professional societies. I have to say, I have been encouraged as a frontline infection preventionist and nurse to see this, and just encouraged to see the work that you all are doing. Dr. Brule.
Physician organizations like the AAFP and IDSA have a crucial role to play in standing up for evidence-based policies and pushing back against the harmful rhetoric that is all too common these days. At the AAFP, our focus is on truth, transparency, and trust. We use platforms like familydoctor.org, which is updated regularly with evidence-based articles and resources to make sure that patients across the United States have access to reliable and accurate information. We also stand up as an organization, both individually and with groups of other organizations, and advocate for truth in vaccines and truth in health. Our situation today reminds me of my favorite children's book, one of them, which is called The Emperor's New Clothes, in which a very kind but egocentric emperor is hoodwinked into believing that someone has come to sell him new clothes out of a thread and a fabric that are so fine that only the most important people can possibly see it. And it gets all the way to the point where the emperor is wearing his new clothes in a parade to show them off, and all the people are saying what beautiful new clothes they are, until one child in the crowd says, "Hey, y'all, the emperor has no clothes on." I think that it's organizations like us who are responsible for saying, "That emperor, he's not wearing any clothes."
I love that perspective and reframing of how professional societies need to step forward and point out the truth. That is the theme here that I hear from you, Dr. Brule and Dr. Tan, even through this children's book, is when everything is misinformation, when everyone else is speaking untruth, it is our responsibility to stand up and point to truth and evidence-based science and advocate
the other
for that
thing truth. Too is to get individuals to recognize what the negative impacts might be with regards to the different executive orders that are being put out there. Because you know, what I've learned in the last couple of months is that many of these individuals do not think about what the backlash of this is going to be. And once you get them to sort of understand what the impact and the backlash is, then it really gets them to think about it harder and to really understand why this is not good for the American public.
Mm-hmm. I've appreciated that a lot from your society, Dr. Tan, as well as yours, Dr. Brule, and others, the translation of some of the executive orders and new public policies to the frontline providers and to the public, and to emphasize and to highlight what the impacts of these are, even if they're not immediate impacts, what the eventual impact will be. That translation, I think, is very helpful in being able to raise awareness and spread truth again as an advocate for that. Now, speaking of leadership, let's talk a little bit more about how individual clinicians can partner with their professional societies to lead the way from wherever they are and whatever practice they're at. So I want to open this up to the entire panel. What is one practical thing that every clinician should start doing to combat vaccine misinformation. I think so often it's so easy to look at what everybody else should be doing, and it's difficult to think about what we ourselves can do, one single person can do. So Dr. Benjamin, what do you think what practical thing can every clinician start doing to combat vaccine misinformation?
I think the most important thing that they can do is know what the common myths are around vaccinations. And then understand what the evidence-based answers to those questions are so that they're armed with addressing those when patients walk into their offices.
Informing themselves first so that they're able to inform their patients in the exam rooms.
Absolutely.
That's great. That's great. Dr. Brule.
To keep it short and sweet, I think that every family doctor can make it routine that we talk about vaccines at each visit and capitalize on the continuous relationship that we have with our patients, always offering the opportunity to make a healthy step in the right direction.
Yeah, this is not a taboo topic. We're going to talk about this every exam, every patient visit. This is just normalizing these conversations. It's great. Dr. Schaffner?
All of those things, of course, very, very important. But secondarily, physicians are members of their local Rotary and their Lions Club, et cetera, et cetera, their Kiwanis. They can offer to talk to those groups, answer their questions about vaccines. Perhaps the local chapter of the AAP or whatever can put in an editorial, an op-ed in the local paper. Be ready to answer the questions of your local journalists and reinforce the importance of vaccination. Communicate in as many forms and opportunities and forums as possible. But I'll come back to what my colleagues have said, day to day with each patient, listen and then provide reassurance.
Thank you for that, Dr. Schaffner. Again, we know that our clinicians are trusted by the communities. Our providers are trusted and their opinions are trusted by our communities. So wherever you are, you can be speaking in your community about the truth of vaccination. Going back to what you said earlier, Dr. Schaffner, I'm thinking maybe I will volunteer for the next middle school job shadow day and teach all of the middle school friends of my boys about the importance and the effectiveness of vaccination. You know, we can lead where we are. Dr. Tan.
Well, I would say also, I mean, I agree with everything that's been said, but I know Dr. Benjamin brought this up with regards to a lack of adult healthcare providers understanding the importance of vaccines in their patients. So we all can educate them to get them to better understand why vaccines are so important for their patients and get them to talk to their patients about the need for vaccination. That's another thing that I think we need to do, but I completely agree with reaching out to community stakeholders and having them understand why vaccination is so important so that, you know, they can talk to their constituency whenever they have a meeting about this.
Yeah, thank you for that, Dr. Tan, and bringing it home back to the clinics, back to the exam rooms, back to our own staff, where there might actually be some misinformation within the clinical staff that we work with, our colleagues that we work with, and being able to arm and equip them with the words and the tools to work with their patients and recognizing the importance of vaccination. And finally, Dr. Vega.
Well, I love all the wisdom here. Thanks to all of you so much. So many important messages. But I would just bring up the concept of self-care for us and the healthcare team. You know, we all went into this profession to try to help patients, to partner with them. And here we're seeing an issue where we might be really diametrically opposed. And that's something we talked about, strategies to work through that, but it can be tiring and it can be frustrating and it can make you feel angry. You're not going to get everybody, but if you keep trying, you'll get a good number. I think you'll get a majority if you really practice in a patient-centered way and use some of the techniques that have been so eloquently described here today. But don't give up. But also, when you go home at night, don't take that home with you. relax. You know, you're gonna, there's another chance tomorrow, and just take the long view.
Yeah, thank you for that, Dr. Vega. I think there's still that sense of burnout in the healthcare community after what we've been through with COVID, and then over the last 5 years, and then now that the encouragement of being persistent and to not personalize that I think is so important for everybody listening in to hear. But it's time for some closing thoughts. I'd love to hear any final words that you might have on this topic. Dr. Vega, actually, since we're already talking with you, let's go ahead and start with you. Any final closing words that you would have for listeners today?
Yeah, I mean, we've faced different health crises and challenges before, and it's just, we think back to, you know, where we were just a few years ago and how we really started to band together, and everybody was working to the best of their abilities in a crisis. And unfortunately, I think we're facing another crisis right now, but we've shown we can overcome, and we want to maintain that integrity to our professions, certainly, but to our patients and communities as well.
Thank you for that. And Dr. Tan, any final words?
So, I mean, I think, you know, it's really important as healthcare providers that we continue to work together to continue to strongly advocate for our colleagues as well as our patients, and really strongly endorse the use of vaccines as the best way to protect them against these vaccine preventable diseases. Because I think, you know, they trust us, and we need to basically provide the best care that we can. And we all need to work together to basically try and increase vaccination rates among all different age groups.
Absolutely. Dr. Schaffner, any final words?
Well, I think I might end on a lighter note. I'm thinking back of a voluptuous Hollywood star, Mae West of yesteryear, who I don't think was thinking about vaccines when she said, "Too much is not enough." But it could have worked for vaccines.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that into the conversation. Dr. Brill.
Well, I'm going to continue the quotes from others. One of my favorite quotes is a Chinese proverb, which says the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is today. So vaccines are safe, they are effective, and they save lives. And today is the best day to get vaccinated if you haven't had a chance to do so before now.
Thank you, Dr. Brill. And Dr. Benjamin?
You know, I trust my patients. I trust vaccines. And I think that, I get up every morning thinking about how to improve the health of the American people through the association in which I work. And, you know, we believe that vaccines are one of the most effective tools that we have. So I think as we go forward and we're in this relatively hostile environment against vaccines, I think we should just remember that. Patients are pretty smart, and if we give them the right information, they'll make decisions that will improve their health, which means they'll get vaccinated.
Absolutely. Well, I want to take this time to thank you all for such an honest, insightful, and deeply, deeply important conversation. Today, we've had the opportunity to explore a lot of things, not just the science of vaccines, but we've confronted that fragile intersection between public policy, perception, and the trust that the public has in us. And we've acknowledged a lot of things, the extraordinary power of scientific innovation, but also the responsibility that comes with it. So to each of our panelists, I want to thank you for your time, your commitment to medicine. The future of vaccination in America is not going to be shaped by science alone. It's going to be shaped by the stories that we tell, the conversations that we have with our patients in the exam rooms, and the trust that we're working every day to rebuild. So let's keep challenging the assumptions, connecting with our communities, and speaking boldly in defense of scientific evidence, empathy, and health equity. Thank you for joining us today in this critical conversation and for being a part of the solution to rebuild trust in vaccines and strengthen public health. The conversation doesn't end here. It will and it does continue with you in every clinic, in every community, and in every corner of this country. Thank you.
Again, that was a roundtable discussion around vaccine hesitancy in America. My name is Keith Reynolds, and on behalf of the whole medical economics and physicians practice teams, I'd like to thank you for listening to the show and ask that you please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss the next episode. Also, if you'd like the best stories medical economics and physicians practice publish delivered straight to your email 6 days of the week, subscribe to our newsletter at medicaleconomics.com and physicianspractice.com. Off the Chart, a Business and Medicine podcast, is executive produced by Chris Mazzolini and Keith Reynolds and produced by Austin Luttrell. Medical Economics, Physicians Practice, Infection Control Today, and Patient Care Online are all members of the MJH Life Sciences family. Thank you.